With bureaus in London, New York, Jerusalem, and Tua Tapere, this is Shire Network News for the week ending Sunday, June the 5th, 2005.
Welcome to the official podcast of SilentRunning.tv. I'm your host, Tom Payne, not my real name. We've got a new regular feature for you this week. Famed Texas humor blogger Lawrence Simon will be joining us each week from now on for a segment called Full of Crap. This week he tells us why Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas is full of crap. A British academic boycott of two Israeli universities was recently overturned, but things are still a long way from normal. We'll be hearing from Danny Strong from the Union of Jewish Students in London about the political climate on British campuses and how Jewish students and allies are responding.
It wasn't actually just Jews who were proposing the boycott overturn. It was actually particularly coordinated by a group of left-wing academics who were anti-boycott on the basis that it specified Israel to the point that it was anti-Semitic.
Also, left-wing secularists should flee, because we'll be speaking to a Christian conservative blogger. Ooh, scary. Handmaid's Tale, Theocracy, Republic of Gilead. The twist in the tale? She's black.
I'm different because I'm outspoken, and I'm not a registered Republican. I am a conservative and a Christian. I am helping other black people who consider themselves on the fence. I'm helping them to find their voice.
That's prominent Washington, D.C. blogger LaShawn Barber, and she'll be coming up towards the end of the show. But first, blog news. Of course, the big news, the incredible news, the news that struck us all like a thunderbolt and caused us to question the very basis of Western civilization, was that some copies of the Islamic Holy Book weren't handled correctly at the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Beheading hostages? Yawn. Suicide bombings that blow up civilians? Par for the course. Hey, ramming airliners into buildings and slaughtering thousands of Americans? What do you expect? But touch a Quran without gloves or go for a pee next to an air conditioning duct and accidentally, mind you, have some drops of urine fall on the sacred scriptures and it's me lie all over again. Actually, there have been instances at Guantanamo Bay in which Qurans have been ripped up, been used as pillows, been flushed down a toilet, and, yes, been urinated on by the inmates. This is one of those cases where you actually have to find the original sources and read the report, because the media are spinning this story as if their existence depended on it, which in a way I suppose it does. Captain's Quarters blog nails it. Here's a quote. "Guess what, people? This is a book. It's not the Ark of the Covenant, or Muhammad's horse, or a splinter of the true cross. If American servicemen at Gitmo have beaten or tortured prisoners, we need to know about it and put a stop to it. However, all of this hue and cry over how we treat printed material, and even the steps that the Pentagon put in place to treat it respectfully, such as wearing gloves and such, demonstrate a complete lack of perspective about who and what our enemy is. The media and the leftist establishments, such as the ACLU and Amnesty International, use crap like this to set up impossible standards of behaviour and then pretend we're no better than our enemies when we fail to perfectly meet them." Yes, and when the Muslims riot and people are quite possibly killed because the Western media can't resist spinning this story so it harms a war they don't personally believe in, are they going to take responsibility for it? Fat chance. Although it happened a long time ago, the murder of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old black youth murdered in Mississippi, made news again this week. Now, this occurred back in 1955, so let me refresh your memories. Emmett Till had come down to Mississippi from his hometown of Chicago to visit family. This being the 50s, he knew about discrimination, but even so, Chicago wasn't quite as bad as Mississippi, and he broke the unwritten code of behavior down there by making some sort of remark to or whistling at a white woman in a shop. Later in the week, two white men came to his grandfather's house at night, found him, dragged him out of bed, and drove off. A few days later, his body was discovered, battered beyond recognition in a river. When photos of his body were published in black newspapers, there was a surge of revulsion. Many people point to this incident as the real spark to the civil rights movement. Now, the reason this was in the news this week is that federal investigators exhumed Emmett Till's remains, saying DNA or other evidence might help determine who killed him and whether anyone still alive should be prosecuted. Okay, my personal opinion, for what it's worth, is that maybe, just maybe, the authorities might care to look into the remote possibility that the people to investigate could just be the two men who confessed to it in a magazine article. Call me a crazy nut who jumps to conclusions, but Is it possible that Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam's account of how they murdered Emmett Till in Life magazine, which appeared after they'd been acquitted by an all-white jury, may have had something to do with the murder? Of course, there may still be people in Mississippi who cling to the theory that Emmett Till bashed himself into a bloody pulp, shot himself through the head, and tied a cotton gin fan to his neck with barbed wire before hurling himself into the Tallahatchie River, all to make white folk look bad. Maybe it was part of a communist conspiracy. Emmett Till was murdered by Bryant and Milam. Both men escaped justice after a travesty of a farrago of a mockery of a trial and died in their beds decades later. That's what happened. Unless we can bring them back to life in order to try them again and execute them, or unless someone still alive had something to do with it, I'm not sure why Emmett Till's grave is being disturbed again. More information can be found at the Emmett Till blog, which is run by Susan Klopfer, who lives in Parchman, Mississippi. This week saw the anniversary of the day in 1989 when, in Tiananmen Square, Beijing, the Chinese government says absolutely nothing happened. Australia marked the occasion in true Anglospheric style by having a Chinese diplomat defect. Cheng Yonglin, a consular official in Sydney, has applied for a protection visa for himself and his family and says he's angry about the Chinese government's human rights record. He is hoping he gets to stay in Australia and that many more Chinese officials follow his example and start telling the West what a communist dictatorship is really like. Some leftists, of course, mark the Tiananmen Square massacre anniversary with the kind of weaselly truth-twisting and total lack of morality we've come to expect. Here's the way Workers' World excuses the use of tanks against students. What would have been the effect had the student demonstrations contributed to fracturing China's socialist government, which had already gone through decades of internal struggle over what road to take? At the time, only speculation was possible. Now, you only have to look at the collapsed Soviet Union for a measure of the human destruction such a counter-revolution would wreak. In China, a developing country with over 1 billion people, the devastation would have been magnified tenfold. Yes, the Chinese Communist Party, they may be sons of bitches, but they're our sons of bitches. For the record, the man who stood in front of the column of tanks, the incident which was captured by TV cameras and became the symbol of the Chinese democracy struggle, was Wang Weilin. He was later arrested and shot. No word so far on what political line Workers' World have decided to take on his execution. As Canadian blogger Damien Penny notes, Chairman Mao may be dead, but he's not nearly dead enough. Natalie Solon, who writes for the biased BBC blog, is branching out, not satisfied with detecting bias in the news. Let's face it, that's easier than shooting fish in a barrel, more like potting a shark in a bathtub. She's found the BBC lefty lovey's worldview infecting episodes of the new Doctor Who. Here's a quote. The Doctor saves the day, as usual, and makes a parting request to the Blitz-era Londoners who owe him their lives, and don't forget to create the welfare state. Natalie Solnit is quite right. The bias seeps into absolutely everything, she says. Just imagine the outrage if one of those little asides had been directed the other way. Oh, by the way, says the Doctor, that welfare state stuff is a bad idea. You end up with loads more 15-year-old mothers. And finally, in blog news, you'll be pleased to know that an expedition to the North Pole has had to turn back. The One World Expedition was attempting to raise consciousness about the awful threat to the globe posed by global warming. Unfortunately, they had to turn back when it snowed too much. In other news of impending global catastrophe caused by ruthless capitalist exploitation and, of course, the failed Bush administration, the West Antarctic ice sheet is actually getting thicker. The New Scientist reports that a new radar study shows that the ice sheet feeding the Ross ice streams is growing. That's a dramatic change in an ice sheet covering about a third of West Antarctica and that's retreated nearly 1,300 kilometres since the end of the last ice age. The discovery comes a few days after another team claimed that most of Antarctica is cooling down, not warming up, a conclusion that conflicts with greenhouse gas climate models. This causes the New Scientist to opine, the big question is if the change marks the end of the treat or just a short-lived reversal. Funny how that kind of comment only ever gets dragged out if evidence against global warming comes to light. If a larger-than-usual iceberg breaks off from Greenland, the shrieks of doom from our self-appointed eco-prophets are deafening. So, just reviewing again. Evidence against global warming? Questionable. Evidence in favour? Holy scripture, which it is blasphemy to contradict. A British academic boycott of two Israeli universities was overturned recently. This win comes with a bit of a warning, though, with UK blogger Melanie Phillips arguing that it was overturned by the Academic Teachers Union on the ground that boycotts are not the most effective means of struggling against the evil Israeli regime with its jackbooted policy of trying to stop Palestinians murdering its citizens. She says it should have been argued against on the basis that almost everything the boycott's proponents said was a disgusting lie. If you don't challenge the lie, after a while, the lie becomes a fact by default. At the forefront of the political struggle on British universities is the Union of Jewish Students, and I asked their campaigns officer, Danny Strong, about the prevailing atmosphere.
It can be very difficult at the moment for Jewish students. Obviously, there's a lot to be proud of, and there's a lot of positive things that are happening. But we've had a worrying trend of increasing tension on campus. What tends to happen is that the tension on campus mirrors spikes in tension in the Middle East or incidents in the Middle East. For example, the assassination of the Hamas leader, Sheikh Yassin, led to a number of anti-Semitic incidents, and that affects the general community, but more specifically, it's seen in the microcosm of campus. In the bigger Jewish societies, places like Leeds and Birmingham and Manchester, we've seen anti-Semitic graffiti, be it a swastika painted on a toilet door to, in Leeds, a particularly shocking piece of graffiti which said, did Hitler have the right idea, and had a tick-tock chart of yes and no, and the yes side had been filled in. We've also had issues with academics, particularly, obviously, the proponent of the boycott, Sue Blackwell, who had links on her site to various sites purporting that Israel had committed the September 11th attacks onto Holocaust denial or what have you. But then, specifically, we've had incidents, most worryingly, at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, where we've had articles in the student magazine supportive of suicide bombing, videos, anti-Semitic videos in the student lounge, a speaker who said it would be a rational act to burn down a synagogue.
What effect is this having on the political stance of Jewish students? I mean, when you get people attacking you, you tend to get a bit more unified. That's been my experience anyway.
Yeah, I mean, what we've had is a kind of a two-way divide, in that Jewish students will do one of these two things. One is that they will, unfortunately, disassociate themselves from their Jewish identity, the Jewish community, the Jewish student community, and stay quiet. And that's something, obviously, which is tied into the boycott as well, which is whereby if they don't start talking out about Israel or they don't support their right to be a Zionist too loudly, then they're considered okay by a potential boycotter. What the other way that in which Jewish students go is, as you say, a more positive direction as far as certainly as I'm concerned or the Union of Jewish Students is concerned, which is that they will identify strongly. They won't be bullied into kind of subverting their identity, and they will become more active on campus.
One of the criticisms that I've heard of Anglo-Jewry generally is that staying quiet is their default position. Is that changing at all as a result of what's happening on campuses?
Certainly. I mean, that is a criticism that's leveled very often. I think that it's difficult sometimes for a lot of communities to perceive what's happening because the British system is such that not everything works by standing up, you know, shouting very loud. There is a lot of process and dialogue that goes on at all different levels. So it's not always the first response to demonstrate or to shout out. But what's been very positive in the past year or so is there's been a lot more coordination between the community, Jewish community, and communal groups, which has meant that a lot more of the community in the UK is feeling that there's more action taking place. And certainly a lot of that has been in response to incidents on campus. So over the past few months specifically, there's been incidents at one particular campus in London, the School of Oriental and African Studies. There's been incidents at the National Union of Students and, of course, a boycott at the Association of University Teachers.
The boycott's been overturned, but there's been a criticism of it that the way it was overturned was the wrong way to go about it. It was overturned on the grounds, basically, of freedom of speech. But the criticism is that it wasn't overturned on the grounds that the worldview of the people who put it forward is a pile of crap.
Yes, there's some interesting things to note about it. Interestingly, although, as you rightly say, it is a success for Anglo-Jewry and it's a success for general good practice and moral right. The interesting thing is that it wasn't actually just Jews who were proposing the boycott overturn. It was actually a particularly coordinated by a group of left-wing academics who were anti-boycott on the basis that it specified Israel to the point that it was anti-Semitic. And that they were very clear about that argument. They said, you know, although they oppose certain policies of Israel's government, they think that the specification and the attempt to try and make students and academics label themselves in some way was specifically anti-Semitic.
Well, I suppose a win is a win, but on the other hand, it's come after years of constant grinding battle, most of which has been a story of defeat. What's going to happen 20 or 30 years down the track when the current generation of non-Jewish students who've been exposed to this kind of thing at university are in positions of leadership? They're going to be MPs, they're going to be BBC journalists. I mean, what's the atmosphere going to be like for Israel and for Jews, for that matter, when a generation's had time to grow up with this kind of political influence?
Sure. I mean, well, actually, that's something that we tried to take head on. I mean, UJS has been taking young leaders from the UK out to Israel over a number of years. And obviously people who used to be at the head of the non-Jewish, the National Union of Students, are now in serious positions. You had Jack Straw, the Foreign Secretary, Charles Clark, your Home Secretary, Trevor Phillips, who's the head of the Commission for Racial Equality. All these people have come through NUS, and UJS for the past 20, 25 years has been taking them out to Israel in order to ensure that, you know, that the world leaders aren't just seeing one side of a very complicated story. Although, you know, it's true to say that we've had 18 boycott motions on campus in the past 3 years. We've actually won 12 of the 18 that were put forward. So there is some positive stuff, and it seems like people do tend, when there's a positive campaign run, people do tend to see the complications in the conflict. They do tend to see that boycotting is morally repugnant. But it is a problem that, obviously, we can't reach everyone, and that people are going to be in positions of power who will have had a very negative experience or understanding of Israel. To that extent, it's important that now that UJS on campus and the community at large starts to put into place, I think, legal frameworks to ensure that equality of opportunity is afforded to people who call themselves Zionist or pro-Israeli or what have you, so that they're not adversely affected when people who come through the system, having seen all these negative things about Israel, become people in power.
This demonization of Israel is some sort of uniquely evil state. Now, I use the word evil because that's the way it's been presented. Why is this going on at British campuses? You'd think if there was open inquiry and independence and freedom of expression that there'd be a more positive view of Israel. What lies at the nub of this demonization?
It's very difficult to pinpoint it. You're right in that people try and portray Israel as some kind of pariah state. Israel's labelled things that you don't see any other country labelled. Now, the obvious concern is that this is some kind of link to or justification for anti-Semitism. Now, a lot of people would jump very quickly and say, well, you know, I hate Israel, but I'm not an anti-Semite. Some of my best friends are Jewish. I think there's a fine line. I think that there's become an obsession with Israel, and I don't know the reason for it. I mean, it is quite easy for us to say, well, you know, first Jews were persecuted on a religious level, then on an ethnic level, and now on a national level, maybe. I mean, that is possibly one explanation. The other thing is that there has always been constant demonization of Israel, and that this is now with a new conflict raging with the new Intifada, is just an excuse for people who've always had a problem with it to intensify that problem and to take it onto a wider level, having a larger platform now to do it from because of the conflict.
That was Danny Strong, campaigns officer for the UK Union of Jewish Students. Time now for our new feature, direct from Lawrence Simon, who writes, "This blog is full of crap."
Hi there, I'm Lawrence Simon. You may know me from "This blog is full of crap," or countless other weblogs with the naughty word crap in them. Well, my crap has overflowed the virtual toilet bowl I call a website, and I'm on Shire News Network this week to bring you the Who's Full of Crap Report. Two words, Mahmoud Abbas. Well, everybody knows him as Abu Mazen, but me, I call him Abu Kaki. Why? Because just like some Japanese teenager on her knees clutching a fistful of yen for a rip-roaring bukkake session, Abu Mazen's blowing his wad full of lies and propaganda into the face of the mainstream media, and they're lapping it up and gulping it down like there's no tomorrow. Sunday on ABC, that's America's ABC, not the ABC you Aussies and Kiwis enjoy, during the interview show this week without David Brinkley, some Greek Bill Clinton-loving midget sitting in his chair, a boss was asked if he thought that the era of suicide bombing was over. He said, "I believe it is over. We have started to deal with the culture of violence. We have stopped the culture of violence. And the Palestinian people have started looking at it as something that should be condemned, and it should stop. Let's just check on that culture of violence, condemnation, and the whole stop thing, shall we?" Dateline Wednesday, five members of an Islamic Jihad terror cell were arrested by the Shin Bet, narrowly preventing a plot to send, wait for it, not just one, but two suicide bombers in Israel. Their targets were a coffee house or synagogue and a city bus. Over, huh? Dateline Thursday, the two suicide bombers themselves were arrested, one north of Ramallah, the other north of Nablus. The terror cell confirmed the fact that they tried not once, but twice to infiltrate the bombers and would have made a third attempt on Thursday. Let's quote a Ynet News report, shall we? General Security Services, that's Shin Bet, informed the PA, that's Palestinian Authority, of the planned suicide bombing, named the terrorist, and repeatedly asked the PA to arrest them. The response? Not only was it negative, but the PA security officials also asked Israel to remove the terrorist from the wanted list. Those men had been removed from the watch list. Well, let's just say that there'd be a coffee house or synagogue and a city bus just dripping with blood, scattered with shrapnel, and the air filled with the sound of sirens, all courtesy of that Palestinian culture. And I use that term loosely. Once again, I quote, "I believe it is over. Mahmoud Abbas, you're full of crap."
Thank you, Lawrence Simon. He'll be back again next week with another report that's equally full of crap. If you want more of his stuff, then clearly you need medical help. Failing that, you can go to www.isfullofcrap.com. You're listening to Shire Network News, the official podcast of silentrunning.tv. I'm Tom Payne. Those of you who already read blogs may have already come across LaShawn Barber. She writes from a Christian and conservative perspective, which wouldn't be so unusual except that she's black, and that still raises a few eyebrows. Her blog, www.lashawnbarber.com, has become very popular, and with good reason. I spoke to her this week and found she's a very nice lady. Actually, we chatted for a long time, and rather than throw most of the interview away, I'm going to cut it in half and bring you the rest in next week's program. Also, I'm cheap. I asked her how she got started blogging, and it turns out it was pretty much the same way I did. We both followed Andrew Sullivan's example.
About, 3 years ago, I started writing seriously, trying to get published, and I managed to publish a few op-eds and a couple of magazine articles. And I found that with this biweekly column, there was so much going on between columns, between developing different ideas, that I needed a place to rant about the smaller issues or just semi-personal things. And I'd heard about blogs, I think in connection with Andrew Sullivan. For some reason, his name seems to stick out of my head. I didn't really understand what it was, but I knew it was something like a website that you could update. So I did some research and found out that you could start blogging in 5 minutes for free on a service called Blogger. So I started that blog. It was LaShawnBarber.blogspot.com, November 2003. And I blogged with Blogger for about 6 months, and then I got my own domain. So in all, I've been blogging, I guess, for a little over a year and a half. And as a very political person, I wanted to express some of my conservative ideas and sort of develop ideas that I had to develop into columns. And the blog just sort of took over my life. I don't do the column anymore. I consider my blog a daily column.
and it's gotten a lot of attention, a lot of notice, and that's very pleasing to me because I'm also a Christian, and I get to share my faith a lot and just talk about things from a Christian point of view. And readers, whether they're Christians or not, or conservatives or not, they seem to find something that they like about my blog. Even if it's just to argue with me or to be contrary or dispute whatever I have to say, I really enjoy the exchange. I can't wait to see what happens next. It's a very exciting medium.
You seem to be on the cutting edge of a cultural wave that's coming through America at the moment. A lot of people on the left in America seem to be very concerned that the whole place is turning into some sort of Margaret Atwood-style Republic of Gilead. The Christian conservatives are coming.
Yeah. I've heard people say that they fear that we're turning into a theocracy, which, of course, is ridiculous. But I just don't think they know how to react. I think the decisive re-election of George Bush shocked them out of their John Kerry for president reality. And I live in the nation's capital, and I think only 7% of us voted for George Bush. This is a very blue city. And it was as if someone had died around here, and it was like that for a couple of days, and then the anger started and the theocracy talk and appointing Nazis to the Supreme Court and all that kind of stuff. So
you're a black woman and you're a conservative. For a lot of people in America, that just doesn't compute. How does that work?
That's funny. You know, this morning afternoon I attended a national Right to Life Committee luncheon. And they have a part of their organization called Black Americans for Life, and they were giving out various awards to people like Kay Coles James. She was a former Bush appointee for the federal government, and Dr. Alveda King. She's Martin Luther King's niece. She's conservative, staunchly pro-life and Christian. I was talking to some people at the table. There are a lot of black people who are pro-life, but because it's associated with the Republican Party, I don't think that they want to come out of the closet and confess. They don't want to be identified in any way with the Republican Party, who they consider racist, rich, white men who don't care about the poor, don't care about equal rights and all that kind of nonsense. So I think I'm different because I'm outspoken, and I'm not a registered Republican. I am a conservative and a Christian, and the party stuff sort of comes after that. I am helping other black people who consider themselves on the fence, sort of moderate. I'm helping them to find their voice and articulate how they feel about certain issues. They don't want to become Republicans, but they're against homosexual marriage, redefining marriage, they're pro-life, they're anti-partial birth abortion. But you just don't hear a lot of that because they consider a lot of these things Republican ideas. I think black people are more socially conservative than people think, but it's not the thing that's really played up. It's more of the social program type of promoting welfare and things like that and taxing the rich, just the usual sound bites that you hear in the media. But if you sit down with a typical black American, you'd be surprised at how socially conservative they really are.
Well, this is something that was made very apparent to me when I was at university, and I did a lot of research projects about social changes in America, and I did one on the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who's an extremely important figure in American history, not just black American history. And it became extremely apparent to me that everyone on the left was talking about him and thinking about him and reading his works entirely through the lens of politics. And they completely missed that he was a religious figure. And they were missing more than half of what he was about.
And, you know, traditionally the black church has been the political base in the black community because that's, you know, during slavery and things like that where it was illegal for blacks to gather together politically. They did, you know, things sort of covertly in the church because fortunately they were allowed to worship, so they had to confine a lot of their activities there. And it's just a traditional thing that evolved, that black churches tend to be more political. I don't think they used to be that way, but since the Civil Rights Movement, they're very political, which is why you see John Kerry and Edwards preaching in the pulpit during the campaign. That was so irritating. But yes, you know, typically white liberals specifically skip over that part. Blacks are somewhat more religious, even black liberals, black voting Democrats. But the white liberals don't really focus in on that. They just, like you said, focus in on the politics. Dr. King was a preacher. You know, he preached the word of God. And that's an important part of who he was.
That was Washington, D.C.-based blogger and columnist LaShawn Barber. We'll have the second half of that interview on next week's program. You've been listening to Shire Network News. I'm Tom Payne. Thanks for listening. And if you can, why not drop by podcastalley.com and cast a vote for this show. Until next week, may your God go with you.